It's Saturday, October 21st, 2006. This is James Robertson with Syncom Systems, joined by Michael Lucas-Smith of Software with Style and David Buck of Cimbaron. This week on Industry Misinterpretations, Image-Based Development and Image-Based Deployment. What are the issues, what are the problems, and why is it a good thing?
Oh, that's pretty good. So I don't need to go onto the line at all, James. I'm just using Wi-Fi.
Oh, you're on Wi-Fi, okay.
Yeah, actually, can you both just talk for a little bit so we can see if it breaks up?
Sure, I can chat for a bit. So, James, you're going to talk about the feedback you received from one of the earlier podcasts?
Yeah, we're going to go through that, I guess, and then we'll go through the image-based development topic. Michael said, well, this must be 2-3 weeks ago now, that he had some thoughts that direction.
Yeah. Are you going to read out the email that we got, and then we'll just talk about it?
Does anybody else have an email client open? Mine tends to make noise. I actually closed it.
I just closed it because it tends to hit the network when it decides to check mail.
I decided to copy the email out and put it into WordPad.
Oh, well, look who's smart then.
I guess we had to rely on the Canadian for common sense, huh?
And with respect to the transplanted pancreas cells, it does actually work, Dave. You then have to take transplant drugs because then they're not yours. And unfortunately, it takes the doctors who can do it about half a day to cultivate enough pancreas cells to actually do the transplant. And the transplant itself is really simple and straightforward, but getting the cells is extremely hard.
Interesting.
So, unfortunately, it's not quite viable yet.
Does anybody else want to copy that email into WordPad as well? And
Even though
it makes noise at this point?
Yep, I'll do that.
Yeah, let me mute my side of this, because I actually have a mic that'll do that, and I'll bring up my email client. So, Michael, go ahead and act like... I know you're always tongue-tied, so go ahead and say something.
It's a blah, blah, blah. I'm just opening up that email as well, and I've got to find it. So I get so many emails from this James Robertson guy, it just closed up my inbox.
Yeah, I was getting lots of emails from Smalltalk Central, which I still am.
Those ones tend to be
long ones, though, written by Mark.
They're very distressing, actually, I find. Where the hell did this email go? I mean, it should just be here. Weekend podcast. No, that's all just talking about what time everywhere is.
I could probably forward it to you if you want.
I found it now.
I've got it, finally. I actually have a folder that's designed for it, and you can tell how efficient I am that I still couldn't find it.
Okay, let's see. Dear Mr. Robertson, well, he obviously doesn't know you.
Okay, well, I'll read it now. Although I'll have to excuse the, Mr. Beck will have to excuse my rendition of his email, and I guess we'll excuse the fact that English is not his first language.
Hang on, are you recording this, James?
Yeah, I'm recording this.
Oh, okay.
I'll edit, who knows what I'll edit out later. I'll do the same bang-up job I always do.
Uh-huh.
All right, so let's see. What he says is, now the audio level is much better. If I get this right, you invited us to send you suggestions for issues to be discussed in a podcast. Indeed, I have a suggestion. The last few years, I always discussed with friends and colleagues and tried to convince them to use Smalltalk. Mind you, I'm paraphrasing here because of the broken English. From this, I always had two observations. One, it seems that not everyone is ready for Smalltalk. I mean, not his intelligence, but his professional career, education, and the result from his way of thinking. Some people are so deeply fixed in C-thinking, it's astonishing. That could qualify for some of the... an editorial comment. That could qualify for half the people who comment on my blog. Let's see, number two. There's the belief that just another language, in the sense there could not be something better than what we all know. Some people have great pessimism that there may be any better in the universe. This makes it difficult to set up even a test project to show the better thing. So from this, it would be really interesting if you could discuss... Who to introduce Smalltalk to on a team to keep professionals open for new things, or how to convince someone who really could need Smalltalk but doesn't know it himself. So, Dave, Mike, Michael?
Yeah, I wouldn't have a clue how you'd do that.
one thing I found interesting about this, on lots of previous projects that I was on, these are mostly Smalltalk projects, they had problems bringing people onto the project because they perceived Smalltalk as not being a career-forwarding move. So,
yeah, I've actually seen that, too. I've seen that same thing, yeah. Go ahead.
And, in fact, on one project I was on, they had quite a group of Smalltalkers, about 40 Smalltalkers working on some software. And the Smalltalkers, even though they loved working in Smalltalk and they enjoyed the environment, they were actually asking management if they could work on Java projects simply to get Java experience to put onto their resumes.
Are you still seeing that? Because that sounds that sounds 1998-ish to me.
That actually, coincidentally, was around 1998 to about 2000.
Okay.
So I'm not seeing that anymore. That particular team has mostly broken up, and they are, in fact, working on a Java project with a much smaller Smalltalk project still going on.
Yeah, I actually saw the same thing when the company I was working for at the time was going through a bit of a rough period. Some people were being fired, other people decided they were going to jump ship. And a bunch of the developers who I would say were good programmers but really didn't get Smalltalk, they decided they could learn other languages that could further their careers. Now, at the time, that was Java. And since then, one other developer left the company, and he learned C# before he left, too, for basically the same reasons. It's very interesting that of the people who have left, usually they have a kind of a desire to come back to Smalltalk, but they still feel like they're going to trap themselves in some way.
Well, I actually wrote a blog post on this recently with several people from, for instance, the Eclipse Foundation, looking back to the good old days and wishing they could do Smalltalk again.
Yeah, I saw that. It's kind of interesting. It's like they have buyer's remorse. You know, they went down the Java path. A lot of them are even actively working on Eclipse. The interesting thing is there, it's not that I've seen postings of this nature from him, but, you know, one of the previously preeminent people in the Smalltalk community, Eric Klayberg, is mostly an Eclipse add-ons guy now.
Yeah.
Eric Klayberg, Wayne Beaton from the Eclipse Foundation, Mike Milinkovich has been reminiscing about Smalltalk. They all wish they could go back to that kind of environment, and these are people who work on Eclipse. This is the premier Java environment that's available.
Well, you know, and, if you restore state by reading XML files, you're bound to have some disappointment.
I remember in one project I was on, I was trying to convince them to not to migrate their application to another language. Their concern was, we can't find Smalltalk programmers very easily. And I said, well, that's not a problem. We can train them. They said, well, we don't have people who want to train in Smalltalk because they want to train in C# or .NET or Java or some other language where they can sell their skills more easily. The funny thing I'm finding now is there's more and more dissent from especially the Java community, where people are saying, you know, this is just too complicated to do and too complex, and we really need a much simpler approach. We need more dynamic approaches.
Yeah.
And they're starting to look at Ruby.
Go ahead, Michael. I was just going to go back to the idea that boosting up your resume by saying you know language X and you know language Y. Any person who's hiring that's, you know, worth their weight in gold, or, you know, worth their weight, full stop, quickly realizes that the person you want to hire is the person who can pick up a new language rather quickly and, you know, absorb those concepts and start actually contributing to the team as quickly as possible. And certainly those kinds of people do not have to come prepackaged with their language under the belt. They can learn languages very quickly. And they're the kinds of people that you really want to be hiring.
Let me interject one thing. Sorry, Dave. I'm wondering how often this actually comes up now, to be honest, in North America at least. The interesting thing is, it's going to take a little bit of an anecdote. Back when things were really dodgy with Park Place DigiDoc and ObjectShare, and people had legitimate reasons for worrying about stability of Smalltalk in the late 90s, you know, during the heyday of management stupidity, we noticed, at least at ObjectShare when I was there, we noticed that Europe was always more conservative in terms of its, you know, the IT shop's willingness there to immediately jump out onto some new technology. it seemed like North American shops, American, Canadian, I wasn't that cognizant of any goings on in Australia. Michael could maybe speak to that in a minute, but it seemed like North American shops would jump ship to anything new that seemed to promise productivity immediately, where Europeans were much more conservative. Maybe to some extent in Europe, it's just that they've come around the bend and they're catching up to this fad a few years late. I don't know. It's just, I see the introduction of both Ruby, Python, the popularity of dynamic languages in general has kind of ameliorated the problem of people being worried about small talk from a career standpoint. The biggest complaint I see is the one that was brought up a couple of minutes ago with shops complaining that, well, where would I find small talkers?
In fact, just to comment on something Michael said a minute ago, project manager worth of salt would ignore language differences. And my problem is I don't find project managers like that. Basically, I find that anybody looking for developers is looking for specific skills and X number of years of experience in those skills, no matter whether that's what they really need or not, in a sense. They really need someone who understands objects better.
Yeah.
But, I had to really chuckle back in the mid-90s when you'd start seeing things come out, job requests coming out saying, Java skills wanted, 5 years experience needed.
Well, I saw the same thing
with .NET. I've seen those too, yeah.
Yeah, with C# and .NET, they wanted 5 years experience, and the thing hadn't even been released yet.
That one was Microsoft technology. They figure you would have been working with release candidate zero for the last 9 years.
So I am a little bit quiet today, and that's because I've spent most of the day drinking at Australia's version of the Oktoberfest, which, unlike Germany, is actually held in October. But it's a pale shadow of a comparison to the real Oktoberfest.
Well, it's probably also difficult to drink all that beer upside down, too, right?
Well, it gets rid of the hiccups.
About the comment that small talk is just another language, I actually find it considerably different than other languages. And I think Wayne Beaton once had a comment that the best Java programmers are former small talkers.
Well, that gives us an opportunity to segue into our topic that Michael and I have been in theory intending to get to for the last, I think, 3 or 4 podcasts, which is image-based deployed development. That's really what I see as the big difference between Smalltalk and most other languages. I mean, syntax is different, sure, but lots of languages have different syntax. That's not that hard to pick up for anybody, I don't think. The big thing that seems to get people is that if you pick up Ruby, say, or Java or C# or whatever, all the code is always in text files, and at the end of the day, if you need to, you can edit the code in VI or Emacs or whatever your favorite editor of the day is. And that kind of throws some people that they pick up Smalltalk and they have to dive into this image thing.
Yes, I see lots of requests for people who are learning Smalltalk to ask, is there an Emacs-style binding for my keys so I can use Emacs in Smalltalk? Now, what they have to remember is that the Smalltalk image, now, we talked about image-based development. The image actually has 2 or 3 different aspects to it, and most people only think of one. The one aspect they're thinking of is that you can take the status of your system and save it off to a file, and then reload it later, and the system comes back to where it is. But that's only one aspect of it, and in my opinion, not the most important aspect. The aspect I find most important is that while the image is running on your system, all of the code is active, it's live, it's working, and you're sitting as part of the world instead of being in a different world trying to design what your runtime world is going to look like.
Yeah, I mean,
go ahead, Michael.
I just want to play the analogy game here for a second. It's like we're sitting on Earth and we decide we're going to make a new planet, and we basically go through all the process of designing our new Earth, our new planet, figure out everything in advance, then hit the big button, and it sucks up a bunch of energy and replicates a new planet, and then we have to fly over to the planet and see if it's actually what we wanted, and then fly back and do it all again when we discover it's not quite what we want.
And once you get there, the tools you have allow you to look around at the planet and maybe see what's there, but you can't change things very easily.
No, you have the same tools that you had back on Earth. The only thing you can do is, on your new planet, is make yet another new planet. So what if we had a different set of tools that allowed us to create an empty planet and start modifying it en masse. And basically, that's what Smalltalk lets you do, is it lets you rapidly terraform the planet, having to throw the planet away and create a new one every time you want to make a slight change.
Well, that's, and one of the side effects of that kind of thing is some of the things that you get in the Smalltalk toolset that just come more or less by default with it without any real extra work are things like the debugger. Edit and continue debuggers are now available in various job environments, and they're to some extent available in Visual Studio. But you notice that it took those guys literally years to get something that's a partial version of what you have in Smalltalk. And it's pretty much because the analogy you've got holds, Michael. It's that they've had to go ahead and generate a whole new planet, and so all you can do is kind of look at it forensically. One of the ways I used to describe the Smalltalk debugger to people is to say, imagine yourself as either a doctor or a forensic pathologist. If you're looking at a C program or a Java program, you're the forensic pathologist, and the patient's lying out there on the slab in the morgue, and you're trying to figure out what killed him. There's no way to fix him. You can just try to figure out what killed him, maybe. And in Smalltalk, you're the doctor trying to patch him back up.
So, I mean, my analogy is just an analogy, but it points out a problem with the image paradigm. That problem is essentially that you fly over to your empty planet and you start changing things, terraforming things. You can accidentally terraform the ground underneath you to be a giant hole. Right, this may be an analogy, but you can actually put real examples of this into action in the Smalltalk image. I'll just give an example. That I usually give the example that you can accidentally break the GUI widgets and then nothing can actually draw, or you accidentally break the debugger so that when the debugger tries to open up, it has another exception, tries to open up another debugger, which goes into a loop. But one that just hit me recently, actually it didn't hit me, it hit a coworker. I was especially impressed with his debugging ability here. We were dealing with pipes, and our pipe would get lazily closed. Now, when we closed it, we forgot to actually disable the lazy closing as well. So we would be assigned IDs 1 and 2, for example, from the operating system. We would finish using them, close 1 and 2 from the operating system. Then the Smalltalk image would open up, say, the source code file that it's going to write source code into temporarily to write some source code changes, and it will get handles 1 and 2 from the operating system. And then our lazy garbage collect would run, and not realizing that it had already closed, then go and close handles 1 and 2, which were opened previously by the Smalltalk image, and shut down the source code file handles while the image was still trying to write to them. So there's three examples of accidentally terraforming the world underneath yourself. The logical step away from image development is not to throw away the concept, but to alter where you do your work from. And essentially, you want to take on an almost godlike role. Like SimCity, you can step back and terraform the planet without being on the planet.
Yeah, that was the interesting thing is that's a vision that I know has been around in VisualWorks for quite a while. If you use distributed Smalltalk, and I don't know, I think it even still works, you can actually open up remote debuggers, remote browsers and remote debuggers. OpenTalk now does have a remote debugger capability in it. I have not used it much, but I know it exists, and it's actually kind of a cool thing. One of these days I even intend to put the remote debugger port open in my blog server so that I could actually look at serious problems that I don't understand remotely. You definitely would want to be able to keep the whole image. I don't think you want to throw the baby out with the bathwater. There are too many advantages to my mind, but yeah, you can actually blow things away, especially newbies. This seems to disturb newbies a lot, that they'll do something interesting and then the image will just break on them. It seems to disturb them a lot that the image just breaks on them.
Well, it's not just that either, actually. Let's talk from the newbie angle here. We've got this image that seems to contain tools that let you destroy yourself, but it's worse than that. You build your application up and you want to deploy it. When you go to do that, you need to remove all the stuff that's in the image that you don't want in your application. Now, in the Smalltalk world, this is called stripping, and it's a very novel concept which you won't have come across at all unless you've really worked in an image-based environment, which essentially is only the Smalltalk world. And what it is the idea that you take an image that contains all these tools plus your encode and remove all the stuff that you don't want, such as all those tools, from the image to build a deployed application. And it is as weird and as back to front as it sounds.
I've taken kind of the radical approach of not even bothering to strip. What I do with when I put the blog server, for instance, that's just a development image that I've told to be headless, meaning no GUI. So I never even bothered to strip that. What I do to make sure it's predictable and I know what the starting condition is going to be is I created a base image that has some startup tools loaded into it. And then when I start the image up, I know exactly what sequence of events is going to happen. And that way I have complete reproducibility from run to run. And that's the part that also seems to disturb some people is that if you take the tack you're talking about, you don't ever want to build a runtime out of your development image that has artifacts in it. You want to always start with a base image, load things into it, and strip that.
One example of a newbie blowing themselves away in Smalltalk, I came across years and years ago, actually in Smalltalk 80, when I was teaching a course to some high school students on Smalltalk, basically, and one of them cleverly typed in form black white, which form black gives you the black form of the system, and white was a message to forms that painted them white, which suddenly, it suddenly turned all colors black into color white. And so now the system, the image is still running perfectly well, and you're getting white windows with white text and white borders with white menu items.
Should point out that the Smalltalk David's talking about here is a black and white Smalltalk. Really, right. Really way back here.
Back. You're going back in the day here with this. Dave's showing his vintage.
Yeah, this was probably vintage 1989 or so. So, yeah, but that was one of the more fun ones that I've seen. Just now, how do I get this back without being able to see what I'm typing? Eventually, yeah, well, we just quit the image and restarted it.
Well, that actually gets to showing people how you can recover from these kinds of nightmares. Is one of the things I used to do when I was a sales engineer back at Park Place Digitalk and ObjectShare, is I'd bring up an image, I'd go ahead and I'd create a new class and add some methods to it. And then what I do is I'd go to a transcript, say, and type object:nil, and I'd do it. And, of course, if you do that, all manner of bad things happen. The funny thing is the image doesn't crash, it just completely stops responding. And, you know, people would then ask, well, geez, how are you going to recover from that? So, of course, you just kill the image, and then you bring it back up, and you've got the change tools. Now, I'm not going to say that the change tools are necessarily the most inherently obvious thing to use. Some of the menu picks are kind of obscure, to say the least.
Yeah,
but
it's an inspired tool, that one.
That's a tool that was written back in the day by people who were using small talkish naming conventions, and it seriously needs the touch of somebody like Vasily Bykov, who can go in with a toolsmith's kind of viewpoint. But the point is here, you can actually recover everything you've lost, because in Smalltalk there is that transaction log that's recording everything you did.
Yeah, the only thing you have to be careful about is do what you might have done inside inspectors or debuggers that you don't really want to replay back when you recover your software.
Well, I actually think that's a fault of the recording tool there, Dave. I think that aspect of the change tool where it records what you want the system to do versus what you're asking the system to do needs to be separated better so that you can replay what you've changed in the system versus what you've asked the system to do.
Yeah, it probably should. It probably should, but at least you can filter those out. That leads me to another interesting anecdote. This goes back into the, probably the early 90s, probably like 94-ish. I remember we got a support call, maybe 94, 95, we got a support call at Park Place from some poor guy who'd been developing an application on a Mac for 6 months. And he said one morning he came in and there'd been a power outage, and when he brought his image back up, his application was gone. And it turns out that for 6 months he'd never saved an image.
Wow, that's quite a long time.
Yeah, so we had to explain to him that, well, you can go through the change tool. Of course, it's going to be a little painful.
Another interesting story. I went to help out a company for 1 week with a performance problem. They were using IBM's Visual Age Java. No, it was VisualWorks, come to think of it. But it was with Envy. And I did some work to try and figure out a few things. I wrote a bit of code. Then I asked them, okay, do you mind if I save the image? And they sort of looked at me with this blank look. What do you mean? I said, here, this file save image menu item. Oh, well, what does that do? We never use that. And it turns out that the way they developed was that every morning when they came in, they would load a config map in from Envy. Then they would do all their work, and at the end of the day, they'd publish everything back to Envy, and then shut down Smalltalk without saving the image and come back in the next day. That was just their mode of development.
Mm.
And I found it very weird. They looked at it when I showed them what it did and restarted the image, and it was right back where it started from. They go, wow, I never knew it could do that.
Well, you know, you get people who are very leery of saving images even. I mean, when we brought this topic up, and I think it was in my blog, I brought this topic up a while back about saving images, and there's always one of our customers, actually, whenever I bring the subject up, it's like talking about type stuff with Isaac Gouet. It's sure to bring a comment or 10 from him. If I talk about image-based stuff, I am certain to get something from Jim Thompson, you know, and he'll rant about how bad this is and how unstable it is. Some people just apparently had bad experiences with images and never trusted.
Well, I'll throw my hand up there. I mean, I've had some shocking experiences with image saving. You get kind of used to the idea that you can just save the image, but we aren't the operating system in the Smalltalk, right? So we have connections to resources outside our image. And if you save the image with those resource connections there, when you start the image back up again, it'll still think it has those resource connections. So, for example, database connections is a classic example. And back in Visual Age, which I do a lot of development in still, the database code is not built around the idea that maybe the database has disappeared. So if you do save your image while connected to a database and then bring it back up again, you have a hell of a time actually trying to destroy the objects that are trying to talk to the database. It's exceptionally difficult. And you get slightly worse problems in VisualWorks when you, say, connect up to a WinGDI Plus image and then hold on to that handle, save the image, and then bring it back up again. And if for any reason you try to display the image object, of course, the handle points to somewhere, unfortunately, it's you know, well, a C program, and it'll just try and do stuff and get an access violation, and in most cases, kills your entire image. So there are certainly limitations to the whole save the image thing.
Oh, certainly there are limitations. Yeah, there's no question about that.
My advice to people is normally go ahead and save your image and use an image for development, but you should frequently, maybe once a week, rebuild the whole system from bottom up, from scratch, basically, using just the code in the source code repository.
Well, this
because if you don't ever do that, then after a while, you start to lose the ability to do it.
And there's another point to that, too, Dave. That's exactly right, because sooner or later, in almost every project, you need to share that code with somebody else who doesn't have your image. And if your code doesn't load cleanly without weird instructions or download this, download that, install this sort of stuff, then your code is extremely difficult for them to use.
Well, I've seen this. I saw this more with Envy setups. I don't think it was inherent to Envy, but I saw more with Envy setups back in the old days than I have recently. And I'm not sure why that is, but I've seen situations where people would trundle along with a development image, and they would get to a point where they would be able to restart from a certain base image they had lying around. But that base image was kind of a god image, if you will. No one knew how it had been built, and nobody knew how to go back to the time before that image. And so if they ever needed to really restart completely from scratch, they were helpless. I've seen that, like I said, I tend to remember seeing a lot of that in Envy. I'm sure there are people using Store or even just trying to somehow depend on changelist as change sets as their way to develop who've run into the same problem. But that's something that tends to throw people off images too, is when they get the magic image that nobody knows how to build anymore.
Well, can I?
One of my philosophies when I'm advising people on source management is what I call a one-click load or one-touch loading. Basically, you have to be able to go to one spot in your system and say load and have from a clean image and have everything load in perfectly and be up to the point where it's running. If you can't do that, then you're going to have a very hard problem rebuilding that image later.
And this, we also do the same for actually doing builds. You should be able to reproduce the build the same way from the same set of source every time. So can I just ask both of you a very simple question? We've spent a big chunk of this time talking about all these nasty things with images. What about images are actually good?
I think actually working with the objects is probably the most important aspect of images.
Can I be a nasty interviewer and interject and ask and say, but that can be achieved in other ways?
Well, what I find is that when you work in Smalltalk, it's sort of like playing with Play-Doh, and you can carve it, you can mold it, you can see what you're dealing with very close contact. When I'm working with something like Java or C#, it's sort of like trying to stand across the room with 15-foot sticks and trying to mold my Play-Doh that way. It doesn't work as well.
Yeah, okay. So C# and Java don't come with the ability to change things like Smalltalk does. But again, I'm just going to throw the question in, or the point in, that the ability to manipulate objects like that doesn't require an image.
Let me put it this way, Michael. Sure. The way I tend to look at that is I can answer this kind of question the same way I answer the question about static typing, dynamic typing. You'll have people who will tell you that you can eliminate a whole class of errors by having static typing. And my answer to that tends to be, yeah, there's certainly a benefit to that. The difficulty is that I think in terms of what it does to lock your code down, the cost is higher than the benefit. And I think the same thing goes for images. There's certainly a cost to using images. You can end up, if you're not careful, with a system that's hard to rebuild. You can end up, if you're not careful, with systems that are saved in a state that's not understandable. But the benefits, you know, of having that Play-Doh-like consistency to your objects, to being able to easily go in and just change things on the fly, you know, the fact with my server that I run the blog on, if I want to add capabilities to it, I don't have to recycle the damn thing. I can just go in and add new code to it on the fly. I don't have to play the game of taking it down and bringing it back up. There are a lot of nice benefits in terms of being able to keep things running on a constant basis that you just don't get as easily or in some cases at all with the other kinds of systems.
Okay. And James, if I could make a point about what you do with the blog server, a lot of people are very afraid that you're going into a live production system and sort of mucking around and experimenting and trying this and trying that. That's not what's happening. You're doing all the testing and experimentation in a development image that parallels the production image.
Yep.
And once you're happy that everything works, then you take the changes, package those changes up, and push the changes to the production server, and then it can pick up those changes without recycling.
Sure, and that's exactly what I do. I used to back when I first put the thing up and I had like 3 readers, I would sometimes bring it up with, you know, remotely through X11 and actually debug the thing on the fly just because it was easier that way. But now, you know, the traffic on it's way too high to even consider doing that. So yeah, I do exactly what you're talking about. I test everything on my local Linux server, save my changes out, throw them to the server, and then load them in on the fly. And generally, unless I've really missed something, things just work. That's how I added the iTunes tag capability that recently allowed my podcast to get syndicated hither, thither, and yon, is because I was able to just drop that stuff into the server. I didn't have to recycle it.
Well, I've stopped playing devil's advocate now, so I'm just going to suggest to people that they need a way to picture what it is we're talking about when we say an image, because the concept is pretty foreign, you have to admit. So let's take an application that we all know and some of us love, Firefox. Right? So that Firefox, when you start it up and you start running and playing with it, it's a running application, and you can bring up a web page, and if you know your JavaScript, you can modify the web page on the fly inside JavaScript, inside Firefox. Now, imagine if you could do the same thing with the actual Firefox code while Firefox is running. That is what an image is. It's actually a running program that just happens to have tools that let you manipulate it built into it. And there's really nothing more to the idea of an image than that.
There's an even closer analogy that most people who have laptops can identify with, and that's what happens when you unplug your laptop and close the shell, and then 2-3 hours later, or after a long flight or after a long drive somewhere, you just open the shell and the thing pops up with all the applications you were running right where you left it. The system has saved an image and then restored the image. You know, that's why when you go into the properties in Windows, certainly, it tells you that I need thus and such much storage space on your swap drive to actually be able to accomplish this. And the reason is it needs to save an image.
That's part of the analogy. The problem is it doesn't show you the, it doesn't distinguish, I guess, between development environments and runtime environments, which are combined in a small talk image. If I'm, I use the analogy of a city. If I'm building up a city and I'm up on a ladder installing windows on a second floor, I have the ability in my image to say, now delete the ladder, and suddenly I'm sitting there in mid-air and I start to fall. That my development tools are right there as part of the image. They help me to see what's going on and to manipulate things, but they are right there. And in fact, I can always go to my, if I'm using a drill in my city, I can go to my drill and say, what happens when I push this button on the drill? And it'll show me the source code for it. That's a very unusual thing for people to be able to do.
Have either of you seen the experimental language called subtextual? The byline is that the programming paradigm in subtextual is literally copy and paste. Now, one of the advanced features of subtextual is it's actually a functional programming language, and it's actually a pure functional programming language at its core, which means that you can have some input state and see the next set of state after putting that input into a method without having actually executed it, quote-unquote. That is essentially the same sort of thing that you can do in Smalltalk, except in Smalltalk you do actually do the run, you do the debug. These sorts of look at how things might be and look at how things are paradigms are sorely missing in other programming environments. And I encourage people to really think about these things and experience them. I know James has heard a lot of people say that debugging is a very bad programming technique. Well, the debugging that they're talking about is absolutely nothing like the debugging that we talk about here. When we talk about debugging, we're right in there with the real source code. We can modify the source code. We can even change the values of the objects that are used in the current call stack. We can rewind the call stack. We can inspect the call stack's actual stack objects. We can look at the bytecode of the actual compiled methods, so on and so forth. It's a very, very different world, and unless you've experienced it, you're missing out.
Yeah, it's one of the things that people just don't see right off the bat. If you're trying to debug in other languages, you really are just a forensic pathologist, and that's part of why people say if you're in the debugger, you failed, I guess. But in Smalltalk, a lot of the time, if I'm trying to write something that I don't completely understand right off the bat, I'll just write most of it, get to the part that I considered hairy, and just say, well, you know, heck, I'm not even going to bother with that. I'll just jump into the debugger there, take a look at the state of the objects, and write the code the right way. When I was first doing RSS support, for instance, for my blog server, I was testing this out on my local Linux box, and at the time, you could fit everything I knew about XML and RSS on a postcard. So I just put halts in my system, breakpoints, and just stopped it at the point where it's supposed to generate. And I'd look at my objects that were in the blog server, you know, the blog entries and so on, and then I'd look at the spec that I had up in a browser window on a different computer and say, okay, well, I want to push this out, and I'd be learning the XML stuff on the fly and just iteratively building the thing up. It made a lot more sense to me than trying to grok the whole thing at once and spew out code.
Alan Knight has an interesting quote where he says, in Smalltalk, if you have an unhandled exception, it throws you into the debugger. In Java, when you have an unhandled exception, it throws you out of the debugger.
We've managed to make it to 41 minutes this time, and I think we even have James Savage's little thing to add on to the end, don't we?
Yeah, and actually I should give my plug to a couple of things. Yeah, I have. I think we've beaten this topic a little bit to death now, so yeah, we'll probably wrap this up and and maybe carry on with other associated topics next time. For now, I think what I want to do is introduce a couple of things. If you have feedback for us, we've got an actual email address that my IT department set up for me, smalltalkpodcasts, that's S-M-A-L-L-T-A-L-K, P-O-D-C-A-S-T-S, at syncom.com, that's C-I-N-C-O-M.com. You can send all your feedback there. If you have feedback in the form of an MP3, that's great. I'll go ahead and play it on the air. Also, we have James Savage sent me a small talk jobs report. He's got a DabbleDB site. He puts up tracking small talk jobs through various engines on the internet. He tracks that the same way I track small talk mentions, I guess. And he says he's open and happy to have volunteers to help him maintain that database if anybody's interested. If you are, just go to his blog on our server. You'll spot it if you go to syncomsmalltalk.com/userblogs and drop him an email through the link on the top page of his blog.
Very good. Yeah, yeah. Subscribe to his RSS feed, actually.
Yep. Well, so do I. It's just, I figure if I tell people that short URL, they can find it a little easier than if I try to spell the whole thing out here on the air and explain subscription to them.
I think we need to invent audio hyperlinks.
There you go. Well, when Michael's a young guy, he can figure that out.
Oh, what you say? You say a word, your computer hears you and takes you to a URL.
Yeah,
that's right.
It's like anything else you've written, Michael. Just go ahead. It should be easy to do with style, right?
Well, didn't they do that in Star Trek IV with Scotty trying to talk to the computer?
Computer. Yes. Okay.
Was that an even-numbered Star Trek movie or an odd-numbered Star Trek movie?
That was an even-numbered one, yeah.
And Wrath of Khan was, what, 2 or 3?
It was 2, I believe.
Yeah.
Okay. So Star Trek 4 might not have sucked, then. The even ones are the good ones, right?
Well, Star Trek 4 is the one that even most Star Trek fans can stomach. That's the one where they go back to 1980 or 1990 or some period.
Oh, the Save the Whales one.
Yeah.
Yes, the Save the Whales.
I was trying to channel Scott Adams there, but not successfully. Go ahead.
Yeah. So, anyways, I think that should wrap it up for today.
All right.
Pleasure as always.
Thanks, gentlemen.
Yes. I look forward to the next time.
All right. I'll see you guys next week.
Bye.
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 Here's James Savage with this week's Small Talk Jobs Report. You can catch up with James at www.syncomsmalltalk.com/userblogs. Scroll down to Message Sends from an Unknown Object.
I'm James D. Savage, and this is the Small Talk Jobs Report. In the past week, 14 open positions have been modified or added to the Small Talk Jobs database. Precision Systems Design has positions in Tampa, Florida, and their client is looking for experience in Small Talk, OOAD, Windows, C, and C++. Staff Logic has 2 positions in Spokane, Washington, and they are looking for people to do Smalltalk application maintenance. Accenture is looking for business systems analyst in Minneapolis with experience in SQL, Oracle, Smalltalk, Java, OLE, and server scripts. Syncom is still looking for a business development manager for their VisualWorks and Object Studio products. CSC India is looking for an applications developer for one of their clients in Hyderabad, with experience in Smalltalk, Java, they can speak German, and has insurance industry knowledge. There are several positions available in Australia for Smalltalkers with banking and financial services experience. An internship for a French-speaking master's student is open in Dakar, Senegal. They want someone with object design experience, and the 2-month project will involve the use of Smalltalk and NetLogo. An agile software development project in St. Petersburg, Russia, is looking for someone with experience in VisualWorks, C#, COM, XML, and SQL Server. At least I believe that's what they're looking for. I'm relying on the Babelfish translation because I don't read Cyrillic and I don't speak German. Pardon me, Russian. For more information about the positions mentioned in this report and the Smalltalk Jobs database, search on Google for my blog, Message Sends with an Undefined Object. That's it for this week's report. Good luck with your job hunting.
And another industry misinterpretations is in the can. This has been James Robertson of Syncom Systems, David Buck with Cimarron, and Michael Lucas Smith of Software with Style. Also, James Savage with the Small Talk Jobs Report. We'll see you next week. Darling,
about the things you've been putting me through now. I gotta talk to you, I gotta be intimate too.